Well, first off, I want to welcome everybody to the Better Together Conference. I hope everybody has had a wonderful time this morning in some amazing sessions. Of course, we started out with Elena Aguilar this morning, getting everybody started for the day. And this afternoon, I'm excited to introduce Dr. Justin Bader. My name is Dave Wakefield. I'm the founder and CEO of SIDME. Dr. Justin Bader is the director of the Principal Center, where he helps school leaders build capacity for instructional leadership. He's a former principal at Seattle Public Schools. He's the creator of the Instructional Leadership Challenge and has helped more than 10,000 school leaders in 50 countries around the world confidently get into classrooms every day, have feedback conversations that actually change teacher practice, and of course, discovering the best opportunities for school improvement. Dr. Bader is also the author of Now We're Talking, 21 Days to High Performance Instructional Leadership, and he is the host of Principal Center Radio, a podcast featuring education thought leaders, and Ascend Live, a video show on the ed leadership job search. So without further ado, I want to introduce a good friend of mine, Dr. Justin Bader. We are in for a treat today, so I'm handing it over to him.
All right. Well, Dave, thanks so much for the warm welcome and the kind introduction. And thank you to everyone who's introducing themselves in the chat. I see many familiar names there. I wish I could see your faces, but thank you very much for introducing yourselves. I very much look forward to keeping an eye on the chat. I know we have a lot of people here, so it may scroll pretty quickly, but I'm going to be relying on your feedback in the chat. So if you don't have that window open, you might just look for that button and be prepared to respond, because I will have a few questions for you, and I'd love to have your reactions. So this is 500 Growth Conversations, Instructional Leadership for the Strangest School Year Ever. And if you have seen the full description, you know we're going to talk about goal setting and professional growth and kind of what's going to be different in terms of supervision and evaluation, knowing that this year is going to be strange. And that strangeness is going to require us to be flexible, to adapt, to maybe pursue some possibilities that were in the back of our minds or on the back burner, but now have suddenly come into the foreground. So we're going to talk a lot about evidence-based conversations and how they can be the foundation of our work in terms of professional growth. But I wanted to start with a little prediction question. In your expert opinion, knowing what you know about your organization's plans, your state's plans, what's going on, what's in the news, on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being completely normal and 10 being completely strange, how weird is the 2021 school year going to be? What would your prediction be? I'm seeing 7, 8 to 10, 10, 9, 8, 9, 8, going very 10 million, I think I saw there. All right, we're getting some pretty high numbers. I haven't seen anything below a 5. Infinity, Melanie says. All right, 11. Okay, on a scale of 1 to 10, yeah, we're getting some pretty high numbers here. And I think, you know, when I see most people answering, you know, 8, 9, 10, somewhere in there, I think we have the intuitive sense as educators that we can handle this, right? Do you feel like we can handle this no matter kind of what it turns out to be, right? We've got that phrase, monitor and adjust. Yeah, just different, no concrete plans yet. We can do this, but part of the problem is that we don't really know what it is that we're going to have to do yet, right? We have confidence in ourselves, we have confidence in our colleagues and the professional relationships and the knowledge and the systems that are in place, and we're kind of ready for anything, but at the same time, we don't want to be arrogant in saying, you know, that we're completely ready, because we don't know what it is that we're claiming to be ready for. So the uncertainty, I think, is one of the biggest reasons that we need leadership now more than ever. So I think there's a kind of a fundamental leadership question that we have to ask ourselves, and that's this. I wanted to share this leadership question to kind of frame our conversation right at the beginning here. And that question is, what does this situation demand of me? So if you're a classroom teacher, asking that question of leadership for your own students, for your own classroom, for your own role on your team. What does this situation demand of me? That is a question that we're going to have to ask ourselves over and over and over again. And there are some answers that we know right now, like Sophia says, flexibility. Yeah, we know we're going to have to be flexible. And we know, yeah, empathy, another one. We know we're going to have empathy for maybe our colleagues who struggle with technology. You're here, so obviously you are somewhat proficient with technology at the very least, and maybe very proficient. We know we're going to have to support each other. We know we're going to help our colleagues learn new skills, and we are going to have to learn new skills. But as a general question, we're going to have to continue asking ourselves that. What does this situation demand of me? Because we know the situation is not static. It's going to continue to change. It's going to continue to unfold as the kind of the facts on the ground change. We're going to have to be, as Cindy says, resilient and adaptable. Absolutely. So I wanted to share a framework from Ron Heifetz at Harvard. You may have heard his kind of distinction between technical and adaptive change, because when it comes to the goal setting and supervision and evaluation process, you know, typically that is a technical process for us. We know how to do it. We know what it's going to look like going into it. Often it's written into the teacher evaluation, or excuse me, the teacher employment contract, what that supervision and evaluation and goal setting process is going to look like. And changing that process is typically very slow, but also, you know, there's not a lot of uncertainty with it. But there's a second kind of challenge that we are dealing with that Heifetz calls adaptive change. So to distinguish between those, a technical change or a technical challenge is something that we can address using our existing roles and skills and knowledge and processes. You know, it's something that we have to figure out, but it's in the language that we already speak, right? For example, one technical challenge that I've seen a lot of schools playing around with and figuring out pretty easily, maybe it's not a good resolution or a good answer, but simply the question of how do we space out desks, or how do we, you know, what do we do to you know, meet the distancing requirements in our classrooms? Well, everyone can figure that out, right? We can move desks and measure the distance between them. And, you know, there are some straightforward technical things that we'll have to figure out that are new, but they're not challenges that require us to draw on skills that we didn't already have. Adaptive challenges require some sort of change in us. They require a change maybe in our organization and how we work together. They require us to develop new skills and new processes, and they don't neatly plug in to our existing processes. So that challenge is, I think, why your leadership is going to be so crucial in the coming year. And I'd like to know in the chat right now, if you could tell me, what kind of leadership role do you play in your school? Maybe you're an instructional coach, maybe you're a principal, maybe you're a superintendent, maybe you are a particular kind of leader on your team, even if you don't have a title or a stipend associated with that. What type of leadership role do you play? Let me know in the chat, because I'm curious what types of leaders we have here. And I want to make sure that we acknowledge the forms of leadership that don't come with a title or a stipend or anything. Okay, was I frozen there for a minute? All right, sorry if I lost you on the internet here, but looks like we're back. And what I was asking just a moment ago is to share what type of leader you are. What type of leadership role do you play on your team, in your department, in your organization, even if it's a role that doesn't come with a title or doesn't come with a different salary? I'm going to guess that based on the fact that you are here, based on the fact that you are engaging in professional learning, that you do play some sort of leadership role. So I wanted to ask, what is that? What leadership role do you play? And this will let me know if the internet is working also. Okay, so instructional coach, tech coach, elementary principal, instructional coach, AP, band director. And let me know on your team. I'm especially interested in hearing this from you. If you don't have a formal title on your team, how do you exercise leadership? Like, what is it that you do within your team that allows you to exercise leadership? Because I think leadership within teams is one of our key functions for what we're going to talk about today. Good deal. Lots and lots of instructional coaches and administrators. Wonderful. Fabulous. Oh, and my chat is scrolling so fast now. All right. Good deal. Program manager, curriculum director, dean of students. Wonderful. So thinking about that role, We can next think about the kinds of changes that we need to make. And in a typical year, most of those changes are technical, right? If not a lot is changing big picture, if we're not in the midst of a pandemic, most of our changes from one year to the next are technical. And I'm not much of a sports person, but I thought I would go out on a limb here and use a basketball analogy. Let's say we want to improve our free throw shooting percentage, right? In the NBA, I think it's typical for an NBA player to make about 75% of their free throws. So if we have a technical challenge, if we see, our free throw percentage is lower than it should be, we have an opportunity there to improve. Improving your free throw percentage is a straightforward technical challenge because it's known how you get better at free throws. You know, there's a form, there's a technique, there are methods and simply straightforward practice that allows you to get better at shooting free throws. That would be a technical change. But an adaptive change requires us to venture more into the unknown. And I'd like you to think about what the adaptive changes that you're anticipating might be. And you can let me know in the chat if you think of one. What might be some adaptive challenges that your organization is facing as we go into this school year? In terms of basketball, a great example came to mind this past winter. I was watching a high school basketball game, and I used to go to lots of basketball games when I was in high school, but I realized watching basketball this year that it has become a very different sport. It has become a much longer game, and it used to be that hardly any players would take three-point shots. You know, we had maybe just a handful of players who would take shots from outside the three-point line. But now I'm seeing high school students shoot from way outside the three-point line, and that's normal, right? The coach doesn't yell at him. The coach doesn't say, "What are you doing taking this crazy shot?" It has become a much longer game because I think shooting accuracy has improved. There's an opportunity for shorter players to not get blocked if they play that longer game. And it's a more complex and fundamental change that has moved into basketball, even at the high school level. And I'm interested in what you're seeing as some of those adaptive challenges in our profession. I'm just gonna look at a couple of these here. Executing virtual learning in a county where 40% of the students don't have reliable internet access. Yeah, not something you can just stand at the free throw line, dribble a few times and shoot, right? This is a true adaptive challenge. Lack of accountability. When we don't have kids in front of us in person, how do we get them to engage when they are at home? Absolutely. Not being there in person for those intimate professional conversations. Absolutely. How to teach in a hybrid model, Denise says, with some students in the classroom and some students at home. Absolutely. Managing student behavior with social distancing, right? We're going to have all these different requirements in place. Keeping morale, resiliency, and growth in a good place. And Joe, I think Joe is absolutely right to think about things like morale. When we're so focused on the technical challenges and the hand sanitizer and the desks and the arrows in the hallway, we've also got to think about the people. That is a big part of the leadership challenge. So a couple of examples that occurred to me ahead of time. You know, how do we teach with half of our students at home at any given time? How do we start the school year virtually if we need to? And everybody's saying, no, we're gonna start in person. We have to start in person. We might not have all the students there, but we're gonna start in person. I don't know if that's really going to happen. You might have your own doubts about that. How do I build a classroom community starting the year virtually? And how do I get, if we do have students in the classroom, how do I get them to work together and collaborate within the safety guidelines that are in place? Right, so we've got a lot of technical and adaptive challenges in mind. And some of the challenges that people listed might be technical for an organization that has experience with them, but adaptive for another type of organization that hasn't experienced them before. Earlier this year, kind of toward the beginning of the school closures, I was talking with a principal in a virtual academy that's been in operation for more than a decade. And they have a ton of experience getting students to engage online, holding students accountable. You know, the students actually log in and watch their lessons and do their work. And they have systems and a kind of a culture in place for doing all of those things. So a lot of what the next year will bring is a simple, straightforward technical challenge for them. But for everyone else who does not work in an organization that's been designed around remote learning, it's very much an adaptive challenge. And we as leaders have to realize the difference and realize what we are asking people to do, especially when it comes to the growth and evaluation process. So we're essentially going from a process of meeting familiar expectations in familiar ways, you know, last year, not too much different from the year before it, into a whole new ball game where we're having to use our professional judgment to solve new problems in unfamiliar situations. That is what I see as one of the most fundamental shifts here, is that because there is so much uncertainty, because there is so much unpredictability, professional judgment is vastly, vastly more important than it normally is, especially when it comes to those kind of big picture issues for the year. So when it comes to supervision and evaluation and all of the, you know, goal setting and all those things that we normally do throughout the year between administrators and teachers, we really have to be prepared to make a shift from traditional supervision and feedback to what I'm calling evidence-driven growth conversations. And it looks like our video might be frozen, so I'll just wait just a second and let me know if you can hear me again. And I'll just wait for confirmation. Let me know in the chat if we're back. Okay. All right. Good deal. Sorry about that. I know we're placing great demands on the internet infrastructure, and we've got some rain here, so hopefully it'll hold up. But thanks very much for your patience. All right. So when it comes to the supervision and evaluation process, I think everything has got to be directed through conversation, right? Our normal processes are not necessarily going to give us the improvement and the focus that we want. So I think if we shift our focus from, you know, the forms and the goal setting and those kind of traditional elements of supervision and evaluation, and reframe all of that as opportunities to simply have growth conversations, we're going to be much more flexible and much readier to deal with whatever comes our way. All right, does that make sense? Are we, it looks like people can hear now. Give me a yes if you're with me, and that will let me know that we are good to proceed. All right, good deal. We've got lots of yeses coming in. Do let me know if I freeze again, and I can pause and we can make sure that it catches up. So let's talk about one of the chief functions of those growth conversations. And one of our biggest opportunities that we have as leaders in engaging with our colleagues, engaging with our supervisors, and engaging in our own professional growth, I believe one of our biggest opportunities is around professional judgment. There is no question that this year you are going to have to use professional judgment more than perhaps in any other year. Right? Just given how much uncertainty there is, your professional judgment is going to be what sets you apart as a leader, as an educator. It's going to be what sets your organization apart and gets you the support and the accolades and the appreciation from parents. If you can exercise sound, wise professional judgment in difficult times, that goes a long way. But as leaders, if we're thinking about the goal setting and improvement process, it might feel like judgment is one of those things that either somebody has good judgment or they don't. It might feel like we can't really develop someone's professional judgment, kind of like common sense, right? If someone has a lot of common sense, it's easy to work with that person. You know, it's easy to make decisions with them. It's easy to set expectations and then trust that those expectations will be implemented in the way that you intended. But if someone doesn't have common sense, what's your reaction? How do you feel when you're working with someone who just, you kind of feel like they don't have a ton of common sense? Maybe they take you too literally, or they obsess over every detail, and it becomes very, very difficult to kind of work with someone who doesn't seem to have a whole lot of common sense. So can we actually influence professional judgment? Can we actually go through a process that will improve people's professional judgment? I believe that we can. And the key element of that improvement work is not setting the right kind of goal. It's not filling out the right kind of form. It's not having the right kind of data. It's as simple as this: conversation. It's as simple as having conversations that get us on the same page, that set the parameters of the decision, that get us talking in the in a common language about a problem, and then helping that person make a better decision as a result of that framing and that calibration. Does that make sense? Seiko says, can we influence by questioning? Absolutely. Sometimes the opportunity is not to make a better decision, but to ask a better question in the first place. So as kind of a general undercurrent here, I want to encourage us to think less in terms of process and more in terms of conversation when it comes to evaluation. A couple of thoughts on how precisely that works. How does conversation improve professional judgment? Well, one of the things that we find ourselves doing when we get into a conversation is we get into our assumptions about the dimensions of a particular problem, and we start using particular vocabulary to discuss that problem, and then we use that vocabulary and that framing to discuss the evidence that we have. If we have a common language, we're going to be successful at that. If we have common parameters for holding that conversation, we're going to be more successful. And just a moment ago, I used a basketball example. And like I said, I am not much of a sports person, but I think it's helpful to think in terms of non-education metaphors sometimes. What if I was a basketball coach and I wanted to have a conversation after the game with maybe a key player? I wanted to kind of debrief the game and talk about how it went. Would I sit down with that player and say, so, how do you think it went today? Would I do that? Would I start the conversation with just kind of a vague, how did it go today? Would I say, how did you basketball today? Or would I even get just slightly more specific and say, so what did you think about our defense today? What would I do to kind of kick off that conversation? What would I do to make that? I want to hear especially from the coaches. What do you do in that conversation with your players? Do we have any coaches of basketball or other sports with us? Or maybe you have been an athletic coach at some point. How do you kick off that conversation with your athletes? Love to hear from you in the chat. Monica is a former volleyball coach. What is that like? Yeah, Kara says, what do you notice? What did you wonder? And right in Kara's comment there, what did you notice? What did you wonder? We immediately start talking about the specific evidence, right? We immediately start talking about what actually happened. And from there, we access our specific vocabulary for that game, right? So if we're talking about basketball, we might talk about our defense. We might talk about specific moments in the game. We might look at footage of the game and say, hey, what went well here? What went wrong? What mistake did we make when they scored? We can kind of look at the direct evidence and use our existing frameworks and our existing vocabulary to make that conversation one that improves professional judgment, right? Because in a post-conference or some sort of improvement conversation, we're not trying to beat a dead horse, right? We're not trying to fix a lesson that's already over. What we're trying to do is improve professional judgment for the future. So a couple of key elements. Again, we're looking at evidence, we are using a common framework, and we're using a common vocabulary to focus people on the decisions they made. But here's the thing. We have been doing this for decades in our profession, right? We have been having these kind of basketball style feedback conversations. And if your eyes are not on the screen here, you will appreciate this this next picture when I put it up here. If basketball, it has been our metaphor for how we do professional growth conversations, how we do teacher supervision and evaluation, how we work between supervisor and employee. If basketball has been the sport we've been playing, this year, my friends, our sport has been suddenly and unceremoniously changed to, does anybody know what sport this is? Let me know if you recognize this particular sport. Pickleball, absolutely. Absolutely. My brother-in-law plays pickleball. Lots of people play pickleball at our community center here. We have had the game change on us. And I don't know about you, but I know very, very little about pickleball. Is anybody a pickleball expert in particular? Yeah, looks like fun. Probably kind of fun. So let's assume you know basically nothing about pickleball. Just based on this picture, what can you assume as kind of a starting point? Because really, this is a great metaphor for the shifts that we're having to make when it comes to teaching online, when it comes to teaching in a hybrid format. Okay, it looks like tennis. Yeah, Helen says it looks like tennis. There's a racket, there's a ball, there's a net, there are lines. Maybe people play with a partner. So it seems kind of like tennis, right? And one of the things that we're going to have to do this year is we're going to have to think in terms of metaphor if that's the most we have, right? If I don't know anything about pickleball, I will be much farther along if somebody tells me, hey, it's kind of like tennis, just like start with tennis in your head or ping pong, you know, it's kind of like huge ping pong or, you know, kind of a modified version of tennis. And that will kind of get you going enough to figure it out. That is the shift that we have to make whenever we are totally disrupted in what we're doing this fall. If I am used to in-person lessons, if I'm used to having all of my students in the room in front of me, my metaphor is going to have to shift a little bit. We're not playing basketball anymore. We're playing some new sport. What is it that I already know about this? And how can I, yeah, there we go. How can I make sense of the situation based on the information that I do have? So if you wanted to help people improve at pickleball, but you didn't really have any prior experience, you would draw on what you do know about, say, tennis, right? Kind of where to stand, how to serve. And yeah, I love the way Carolyn is putting this. We need to use the strategies that have been effective and adapt them to our new reality. Yeah, very well said, Carolyn. Thank you for articulating that better than I did. So as kind of a baseline practice, or as kind of a core practice in our leadership, Dave mentioned, I don't know if I have a copy. Yeah, I do have a copy here. Dave mentioned my book, Now We're Talking, 21 Days to High Performance Instructional Leadership. I have been very, encouraging of the practice and really even adamant about the practice of getting into classrooms 500 times a year for administrators. That has been, for years now, the core of what I've taught administrators to do to be effective instructional leaders. But this year, it's going to have to be a little bit of a game of pickleball if we're not physically getting into classrooms. It's going to be much more about having conversations, having growth conversations with everybody that we work with, whether that's students, whether that's teachers, whether that's our own supervisors. It's much less about the formal observation, the formal goal setting process, and much more about the conversation. Could I ask, how many people have either been through the challenge or have seen the book or have done some aspect of that? And Helen's saying 500 times, how many per teacher per year? Helen, that depends on how many teachers you have, but typically I recommend visiting just the teachers you supervise. That tends to be about 30 teachers, and that tends to be about 15 visits per year. It just kind of varies there. Andrea says she's done the challenge and read the book. And let's see, Michelle says they're using the book in our leadership program now. Eloisa says done the challenge. Good deal. And Patricia, hey, good to see you here. Aspiring to complete the challenge. Hey, Peggy, great to see you. Shanita's got the book. Good deal. So, you know, if you've read that book, if you're ready to implement it, I don't want you to be frustrated this year if you can't physically get into classrooms. Like, maybe you'll get a directive that says you are not allowed to go from classroom to classroom. We need to go virtually, or we need to not be a vector for disease just walking from classroom to classroom. You know, there are going to be some disruptions to that. And the big shift that I want to encourage you to make mentally on this is think of it in terms of conversations rather than classroom visits or observations. And it may be that some of your most important interactions are not based on classroom observation, but they are based on evidence-driven professional conversation. So I wanted to present a simple plan for you in terms of conversation. And Tom says, those of us who are consultants are not going to be traveling from school to school either. Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the big shifts in terms of professional growth, coaching, interaction. I know we have perhaps a lot of people here who work in higher ed, in teacher preparation, and you may not be allowed. Is anybody in that situation where you work as an outside provider and you're not allowed into schools? You're not allowed to go visit your student teachers that you supervise. My wife used to do that. supervised student teachers, and she would drive around to schools and, you know, sit in classrooms and observe. Anybody in that particular situation where you're just not physically allowed to get out there? Nate says yes. Elizabeth says yes. Probably some announcements coming on that front, certain sites that you can't go to. Right. So there is going to be some disruption here, but that doesn't mean that the professional growth and the professional learning have to stop. So let's talk about a plan for having 500 conversations this year. And I recommend that you actually keep track of these. I think it'll be illuminating to actually keep track of these conversations because, you know, there tend to be people that we seek out. Like, let's say you are a principal in a single school, so you're in kind of a traditional supervisory relationship. There tend to be people who seek us out, and there tend to be people that we seek out, and there tend to be people that we may try to avoid, and there may be people who try to avoid us. And because of those natural patterns and dynamics in, you know, just kind of how we interact, we tend to see and talk with some people a lot, and we tend to talk with other people hardly at all. So one of the big insights from the book that I share with people in the Instructional Leadership Challenge is you've really got to keep track. You've got to use maybe note cards or an app of some sort to make sure that you get around to everyone and don't over-visit the people that it's easy to visit and under-visit the people that are difficult or that are hard to, you know, track down. We've really got to be intentional about rotating those visits. And I think the same thing is true when it comes to conversations. We've got to be sure that we are talking with everybody. And that's especially true if we have people working from home, if we have people working remotely. We want to make sure that we are intentionally holding and rotating those conversations so that we're hearing from people, so that we're getting on the same page, so that we're solving problems and talking through them in a timely fashion. So here is just a simple plan for those conversations. I want to encourage you to set a goal for yourself of having 3 professional growth conversations per day. Now, if most of your duties are around working with students, you may say, well, I don't really have time to set aside to talk with 3 specific adults about professional growth. Like, this is more if you're in a coaching or supervisory relationship. But I want to encourage you to set that goal of 3 a day. What are we going to talk about in those conversations? Well, it's going to depend on what you're dealing with. But what I do think we need to get away from, and I want to be very clear about this, I think we need to set down and set aside the forms. I don't know if anybody here loves forms. Do we have anybody who just loves forms and would be heartbroken if we were not allowed to use forms for this coming year, like the carbon forms or the, you know, if you have maybe a memo pad or a sticky note? We don't have any form fans here. I got a no and a nope. If you're not too heartbroken by this suggestion, I would encourage you to set aside the forms and just not worry about them this year. And in fact, I'm not a big fan of forms in a normal year, but I think especially now, we have got to be willing to go after the most pressing problems that are in front of us and say, you know what? This form is not the most pressing problem in front of us. The fact that I have a template to fill out is not the most pressing problem in front of us. We've got to be willing to reallocate our time and attention, which are going to be very, very limited, to tackling those specific problems that people are dealing with. And I don't know what those are today. You don't know what those are today, but we're going to find out very quickly. And we've got to be ready to dive in deep to those pressing problems of practice. And the way that we do that is to talk about practice. Talk about what we're doing. Talk about what has already been done. Talk about what we're planning to do tomorrow. You know, those natural conversations that we have as educators. We have got to make this the primary focus of our instructional leadership work. And I'm hearing about using the Danielson framework for teaching. I love Danielson. I would say use that language, but try to get away from using it in terms of a form. Just use it as your vocabulary. In fact, work toward a framework. The third thing on my slide here is all about having that common language. So let's jump into this 3-step process. I want you to think of this as just kind of a general approach. Anytime you are having a professional conversation, we start with a problem. We start with the most urgent problem that needs to be solved, the highest leverage, the biggest impact. What do we need to tackle right now? And from there, we get into the evidence. What is our current practice in terms of that problem? Maybe As an example, I know this one came up a lot in toward the end of the last school year. Maybe our problem is that students are not logging in and doing their work in our online learning management system, right? Maybe we've set up things in Google Classroom, we've given the students devices, or we've given them logins, and they're not logging in. Well, that is an urgent problem that can make whatever else we were going to talk about pretty irrelevant, right? We've got to have our students showing up. So the next step is simply to talk about what we are doing in terms of practice. But here is where the fact that this is a profession becomes incredibly powerful for us. We can not only look at what we are doing, we can look at what other people are doing. And I'm a member of several very high volume, very busy Facebook groups for principals and for teachers. I think I'm in about two of each. And it's incredible to see people capitalizing on the fact that this is a profession and not just looking at their own practice, but saying, hey, here's the problem I'm facing. Here's what I'm doing. What are you guys doing over there? And seeing the answers come in from around the world, from maybe schools that resumed before yours did, maybe from schools that have even less technology and more students without internet access than you do. This is a time when, like never before, we have got to capitalize on the fact that this is a profession and we can learn from one another, even if that professional knowledge is not stored in a book yet, even if it's not taught by a university yet, we can learn from each other's practice. And never has there been more urgency around learning from each other's practice. And at the same time, I have to say, there has never been less of an excuse for not learning from each other's practice. Right? There is no reason that we should say, well, we've got this problem and I guess we just have to live with it. It's not, you know, there's nothing we can do. Our students aren't logging in. We can only teach them if they show up. Too bad. No, we can solve these problems because we know someone somewhere has solved that problem with fewer resources, with fewer assets, with less time to spare. We have got to seek out those answers and those solutions. And when we seek them out, here is the critical leadership step that I want to encourage you to take within your school. When you figure out those answers, those solutions to that problem, don't just say, okay, I got it, I'm good, and let it go. Turn it into a shared solution. Turn it into a shared framework within your department, within your team, within your school, so that it's not just something that you have solved in your classroom. It's a problem that you have solved in your entire department, in your entire grade level, in your entire school. That is what it means to be a professional, to be a part of a profession that extends beyond your school, and to be a part of a team that extends that professionalism beyond your classroom and to all the students that you serve. So the three-step process: problem, practice, framework. Let's talk about how to develop those frameworks here. We'll break that down just a little bit. So again, the first question, of course, is what problem are we trying to solve and what are we doing to solve it? And once we get a sense of what we're currently doing to solve it or what people who have solved this problem are doing to solve it, we want to start to break that down into components. The Danielson framework has come up several times today in the chat. And so if you're looking for an example of a framework that breaks a practice down into its components, definitely look at Charlotte Danielson's framework for teaching. Give me a me in the chat if you're familiar with Danielson. How many people are familiar with the Danielson framework? Or T-Tess? I know we have a lot of Texas people. She rocks, someone says. Yeah, Charlotte Danielson's work is just incredible for identifying those specific areas that that people might need to work on. Kathy's met Charlotte Danielson. Yeah, T-Test. Yeah, lots of people using either Danielson's system directly or a system like T-Test that's based on it. A lot of, I think, over 20 or 30 states use something based on Danielson. And if you look at Danielson's framework, it breaks each area of teaching down into specific components. So there's this kind of vertical breakdown. You know, what are the subcomponents of, you know, the classroom environment? And then within each of those subcomponents, it's broken into levels of performance. Now, here's the thing. Charlotte Danielson is very smart and has been working on this framework for my entire adult life. She's been working on this for decades. But it does not take 20 years to come up with a good framework. And we're at a moment in our profession where we need to be quick and agile in developing those frameworks, those little rubrics for practice. And I want to just give you some experience with this very quickly now. Let's say we want to solve a problem with checking for understanding. So put your framework development hat on. You can, you know, write Charlotte Danielson's name on a hat and put it on if that'll help you feel empowered to come up with your own framework for this. But let's say in our team meeting or in a conversation with a colleague, we discover that we have a little bit of a challenge around checking for understanding when students are working remotely. We think, okay, we've got this problem. We need to check for understanding. You know, maybe students are watching a video that explains how to do something, and then they're solving some problems, and then I can grade those problems. But I don't really want to sit there and grade every single practice problem that students do just to see if they understood. Like, we've got to find a way to check for understanding efficiently, and that you know, kind of diagnoses what the misconception is. Well, what would you do with a colleague in that moment? I don't know if you're a math person in particular, or if math is one of the subjects that you teach, but once you articulate that problem and start talking about it, you know, how can we check for understanding and provide targeted assistance without grading every problem? Well, what would you do? Well, you probably have some ideas that come to mind right away. You would look at what you're currently doing, and you would start to break that down a little bit. And you'd say, okay, well, what am I doing? I'm looking at the chat right here. It says, prompt metaphorical thinking, embed questions, have programmed answers. Yeah, we could use technology in some way. So what we're going to do in that conversation is we're going to talk about what are we already doing, what's working, what's not working, maybe what are we doing that we could stop, and then we can come up collectively, very, very quickly, with a Danielson-style rubric for that specific thing. And I call that an instructional framework, or we'll just call it a framework here. So how do we check for understanding in remote math lessons? I don't know. I haven't done a ton of thinking about this, but I do know that if you sit down with your colleagues, if you do a little bit of research and a little bit of brainstorming and a little bit of trying things out, very quickly, in just a few minutes, you can come up with a process that will allow you to solve that problem. And even if nobody invites you to speak at a conference the way they invite Charlotte Danielson to speak at conferences, even if nobody offers you a publishing deal for that rubric, for that framework that you develop, it will be powerful. I know you have the knowledge. I know you have the ideas. I know you have the access to the ideas that are out there. And I want you to feel empowered to actually put those down into a Danielson-style rubric for yourself. You can do it, and it is very quick, and it will have a huge benefit. Now, one of the reasons that I'm so passionate about instructional frameworks, this is one of my favorite topics, is that there's such a huge opportunity when it comes to anything new with the learning curve being so steep, right? If we're suddenly having to check for understanding in a totally different way, we have a big problem, and a big problem means a big opportunity. It means we have a steep learning curve in front of us, and if we can help our colleagues climb that learning curve more quickly, there is a huge payoff. There is a huge benefit to aligning those expectations. So if two of us, if just two people in our department figure out how to check for understanding with work that students are doing remotely in math, how quickly can we develop the rest of our department if we put some of that into a framework? Does that make sense? Does that appeal to you as a way to activate the professionalism and spread the insights and the learnings that you have from your professional growth conversations? Give me a yes if you're with me, if that makes sense. We can do more examples if we need to. People have been sharing some specific examples. There are lots of ways we could do that with technology. There are ways we could do some kind of spot checking, but we have got to not be alone in this. Here, this is the thing about frameworks and about this kind of contributing to the profession. We have got to not approach this year as if we are solo practitioners. We've got to approach this year as members of a profession, because that is what we are. So just to kind of recap what an instructional framework is, it identifies specific dimensions of a particular practice. It breaks it down. Yeah, we do want to keep it simple, Anthony. Very well said. We want to break down a specific practice into sub-dimensions or sub categories and kind of be clear about what those are. And then we want to break each of those subcategories down into levels of performance, because that's what's going to create a growth pathway. Again, if you've seen the Danielson framework, you know exactly what I'm talking about. There are lots of other frameworks out there as well. This one is from Kim Marshall at marshallmemo.com, and he has a four-level rubric here around delivery of instruction. I've included expectations and clarity. You know, simply being able to distinguish between poor and mediocre and good and excellent practice goes a long way to getting a team on the same page and to getting aligned in a conversation that you're having as professionals. So if you are, I know we have a number of our Principal Center members here. If you are a Principal Center member, you should have access to our program on developing instructional frameworks. I see Anthony and Patricia and lots of people here. If you are a member and you need the link, just email me and I'll be happy to send you the link to that program. And I will put my email address just in the chat here, justin@principalcenter.com. If you are a paying SIBME customer also, I would be happy to send that to you. So just let me know and I can send you the link to that particular training. But let's move on and talk about goals, because I think one of the things that is challenging and is problematic when we face a great deal of uncertainty is setting goals that are going to be relevant for the whole year. And I think we've got to put that question in the forefront of our goal setting process. And maybe some of the forms, maybe some of the traditional processes need to fade into the background just a little bit so that we can focus on those most relevant and pressing problems. What problems am I trying to solve in my classroom? I don't know about you, but it makes sense to me that should be our focus for goal setting for the year, that we should specifically focus on whatever our most pressing problems are, and we should be willing to allow people to change their goals if the situation changes. Does that make sense to you? Let me know what you think about that, because I feel like the goal setting process is one of those things where we're so driven by compliance, we're so driven by what we have to do, what the process requires of us, that we get a little bit rigid about it. And we say, well, it has to be a SMART goal, and it has to be a quantitative data source, and you have to have a pretest and a post-test, and you have to have a percentage increase that you specify. And sometimes we lose the heart of the goal there. You know what I mean? Sometimes we lose the passion for professional improvement that we all naturally have as professionals when we squeeze it into this just kind of rigid, bargained process. Sometimes we lose the heart. And I want to challenge us all to really keep the heart of our work at the forefront this year, to really keep serving our students, meeting their needs at the forefront. And if we have to be a little bit flexible, you know, if our SMART goal format kind of gets mangled a bit, I think that's okay. Hey, Kelly, thanks for being here. Is that okay with you if we mangle the format and the forms, or maybe just allow them to fade in the background a little bit, if we keep the heart of our work, you know, if we keep problem solving for our students' most urgent needs at the forefront, is that okay? You know, I was really touched and impressed by how many educators got involved in delivering stuff to kids this spring, right? When we say, well, my job is to teach, but you know what? Right now, what our kids really need from us is food, or they really need this device delivered to them, or they really, you know, they need something other than what traditionally it's been my role to provide. It's been amazing to see educators being flexible and shifting, you know, even kind of going outside of their traditional role to meet students' needs. I think we have got to do the same with those kind of processes that maybe have been in place for years, like the goal setting process. We've got to be ready to be flexible and solve the problems that need most to be solved. One of the ways that we can be flexible and still keep the district people happy. You know, I know you still work in an organization that has contracts and deadlines and things like that. So one of the things we can do to make our job a little bit easier is to think in advance about evidence and what will constitute evidence for certain types of goals. And I have to say, as someone who thinks a lot about teacher observation and evaluation, sometimes we suffer from what I call observability bias. Like we value things that can be observed in a lesson by an administrator who's sitting at the back of the room, who's watching the teacher, and the teacher is expected by this process to kind of do the song and dance, right? But we know a lot of good teaching isn't what happens the song and dance at the front of the room. It's what happens behind the scenes. And I think this is a year more than ever where that is going to be the case, where it's not going to be an administrator sitting at the back and taking notes on a laptop and the teacher up front trying to wow the administrator and get all the kids to engage and get everybody to raise their hands. You know, that song and dance aspect of teacher observation, you know, honestly, if that goes out the window to some extent this year, I'm okay with that. But what we have got to do to be prepared for that situation is we've got to think flexibly about evidence. What is going to be evidence of my practice if it's not the, you know, direct observation, kind of traditional classroom observation? So we'll talk more about evidence and a couple of different formats in just a moment. I wanted to touch briefly on this idea of doing less, though. Does anybody have the feeling that in your organization you do too much? I don't know. We might have one or two people here. Give me a yes if in your organization you do too much. If there's too much paperwork, if there are too many meetings, if there are too many requirements, if there are too many documents that have to be created and submitted once a year or once a month or once a week. A stop doing list, Melissa says. Yeah, absolutely. This is a time when I think we've got to double down on cutting back. And I actually propose not just a kind of one in, one out rule. And I think that's a good rule in general, right? Like if we're going to add something to the plate, something has to come off the plate, right? People say, hey, you're putting this new requirement in place. Something is being added to my plate. Can you also take something off the plate so that my total workload and my total stress level doesn't go up? That's a good rule for normal times. I think in these exceptional times that we are in right now, it needs to be a 2-to-1 ratio. If we are going to add one thing to people's plates, we need to take off not one thing, but two things. We need to take two things off the plate, and here is why. Whatever we are adding that's new right now is going to have a steep learning curve associated with it. And everybody who shifted to using Canvas or Google Classroom or some sort of online learning management system very quickly this spring experienced that, right? It's not the same to just teach, you know, the same lesson on Zoom instead of to your students in front of you, right? And anybody who said that it was going to be exactly the same, you know they were lying to you, right? It's not the same. There is a learning curve. There is trial and error. There is, you know, it's vastly more time and energy consuming to do something new. So we have got to really push in our schools and in our district context to get a 2-to-1 ratio. If one thing is going to be added to the plate, two things need to come off. And, you know, if the reason I think senior administrators don't like to do that is they don't like to admit that something that they made you do in the past wasn't all that valuable. So it's easy to just tell people, well, just do this new thing, just prioritize, you know, you make it work. And when we do that, when we don't provide that clarity about what we're actually cutting, everybody makes a different decision about what to cut. Yeah, and Jennifer, I love the way you put this. It's like learning how to be a teacher all over again. Teachers felt like they were back as a first year. Yeah, absolutely. Everybody is feeling that, and I think we've got to streamline as a result. We've got to really cut it back. One of the, you know, kind of key accountability points that often we're concerned about is, you know, what do I actually have to turn in, right? What do I actually have to provide on a week-to-week or day-to-day basis in order to be considered to be doing my job? If you are in any kind of managerial or leadership role, I want to encourage you to be clear, simple, and minimal about that. You know, to the greatest extent possible, there needs to be just kind of, here, I'll give a couple examples here. Just very straightforward expectations on this. You know, if you're using Google Classroom, maybe your expectation for teachers in your department is that they do one post per day. There has to be one post per day with the day's resources and assignments or, you know, whatever it is that you're doing. Maybe if you are supporting students in remote learning, maybe it's your expectation that there be one office hours call per week, or maybe it's three. I don't know what it is. But whatever you do, I want to challenge you and encourage you to keep it clear, to keep it simple, and to keep it minimal so that you're holding people accountable for those basics, but that's not primarily what you're focused on in those growth conversations. You know, this can kind of take care of itself. Hey, are you doing your posts every day? Are you keeping track of your students? You know, that kind of thing. But the growth conversations cannot be focused on those compliance logistics, but can really be focused on solving the most urgent problems. Another thought on kind of cutting back and keeping things simple. Really, there is no reason anybody should be inventing new materials right now. Like, we should not be, making math worksheets from scratch. Like, all of this stuff exists. It probably exists online. Please give people permission to reuse, to borrow, to copy with permission. You know, there is so much that has already been done. We do not need to do any reinventing of the wheel. I think if we just completely banned reinventing the wheel for an entire year, we would be in great shape. All right. So a couple of thoughts on doing this at the team level. If you are sharing teamwork, at the the department level or the grade level, maybe you're rotating responsibility for who comes up with the assignments for the week. Have this conversation up front and say, you know what, we really need to keep it minimal. I know, Janice, that you're an overachiever, but please look, please don't be an overachiever in everything this year. We've got to really get aligned on that kind of straightforward and concise format of doing this. We want people to feel like everybody is contributing equally. And sometimes that means that if you're the overachiever, you've got to kind of scale that back. If you have a pacing calendar, it may be wise to have conversations about scaling back that pacing calendar at a senior level and coordinate that so that people aren't making individual decisions about what to cut. And then when it comes to, holding people accountable for their contributions to the team, these are conversations that we need to have upfront. You know, we need to be saying, hey, look, I know that everybody approaches their classroom differently, but now that we're working together, we're coming up with the assignments as a team, we've got to get on the same page. So a couple of thoughts here around, allowing people to specialize, maybe in an elementary class or elementary school, maybe one person on the team is responsible for the math assignments. That's fine. We've just got to make sure we're balancing the effort involved. All right, so a couple of things as we wrap up here. I'm gonna skip ahead to talking about evidence a bit because, you know, chances are good that we are still going to have to do evaluations in something of a traditional format, but we know that what people are going to be doing in this new school year is not what they signed up for. And let me ask, is this what you signed up for originally when you signed your first contract 17 years ago, maybe? Did you sign up to teach remotely with kids who didn't come in every day and with, a 1 month closure, maybe in the middle of the year? You know, did you sign up for this? Did you have any training on this? I don't know if you did. I personally did not. And I think when it comes to the evaluation process, we've got to recognize that really we are asking people to do things that nobody has been trained on and nobody that nobody signed up for. So one of the ways to kind of think about reframing that shift is really to think again about professional judgment. You know, if we can have those conversations as professionals about solving the problems that are in front of us, about doing what our students need, we can get away from the excessive focus on, you know, the performance of a lesson, filling out the forms, all of that stuff that traditionally drives the evaluation process, and really see it as, am I doing what my students need from me at this time? Am I meeting my students' needs? And how can I solve the problems that my students need me to solve? So in terms of evidence, what are some different options that we have for going through that evaluation process? Of course, there may be some in-person observation, getting into classrooms and taking notes as an administrator. But of course, we can also do things like live streamed video with SibMe. You can pre-record a video and upload it and share it with whoever needs to see it. If you are working in a university teacher prep setting, I know you're probably doing a lot of video that way. But for a lot of people, artifacts are going to be a big deal this year. So, if you're able to observe in person, if you're able to go through the normal process, great. If not, you know, you've got lots of technology options within SibMe, with your smartphone, with web-based resources. And I think there are some huge opportunities that we have as a profession to really give people more ownership of their own professional growth because they can decide what to share in those platforms. It's not as much of a gotcha process, but one that I really think has been underutilized in our profession is artifact analysis. You know, uploading student work, looking at different samples of student work, looking at the feedback that we're providing to students. I think we have some tremendous opportunities this year to streamline, to make things easier for people, and to really capitalize on the opportunities that we have to solve our biggest problems. So that is about what I have for you today. I would love to know what some of your takeaways are. So if you wouldn't mind just typing a little sentence in the chat and let me know what you're taking away from this. And Dave, I think, is going to jump back on here as we wrap things up. But you know, some of my takeaways, some of the things that I hope that you walk away from this with are, first of all, a focus on conversation. You know, this is all about professional growth conversations, getting on the same page, getting aligned, not reinventing the wheel, not thinking that we are the only people facing these problems, facing these challenges, but really working together as a profession to solve those common problems. Once we solve them, not just treating them as individual solutions, but really making them frameworks for our entire teams, and really going, yeah, back to basics, activating professionalism, Melissa says. Let's see, minimal accountability. Yeah, just really streamlining that accountability. Let's see, using the resources that are out there, turning solutions into shared solutions. Yeah, focusing on collaboration and creativity, activating professionalism. Yeah, absolutely. And you can quote me on the let's set aside the forms and the checklists. So if you've had to use forms as a big part of it, you know, if those filling out those forms is pretty time consuming. Yeah, I'm a big fan of setting those aside for this year. Let's see, time for conversations. Yeah, absolutely. You know, some of these may be phone calls, some of these may be emails, some of these may be comments on videos. And one of the things that I want to ask you to do, Dave, I'm sorry I'm running over here, but please comment on this video when you see it uploaded to the SIBME huddle. I would love to have your comments. Maybe you joined late. Go back and watch this in the SIBME huddle and leave some timestamped comments on that. And then that's something you can do with your colleagues as well this year. But I am out of time, so I will stop here. Dave, thank you so much for getting such a fabulous group of educators together.
Oh, no, it was a very informative session, Justin. As always, thank you so much for joining us. And for those folks that will continue on to the next session, we have EdCamp style sessions at 3 o'clock, from 3 o'clock to 3:30. Hopefully you can join in some amazing conversation from 3 to 3:30. And then of course, we have our reflection cast at 4:15 for half hour on all social media channels. Would love if you joined us, as that will be live streamed by TJ and Ann McMullen. So thanks so much for joining us. And let's continue learning today and tomorrow. Have a great one.
Thanks so much, everyone. Bye-bye.